Second case this morning, Malone versus Real Star Life Insurance. Mr. Herzog?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Gordon Beeler disappeared at the end of January 1998. He's now been gone for over a decade. His widow and his children are the beneficiaries of a trust that is trying to collect on three life insurance policies, two issued by ReliaStar and one issued by AXA. Now, the trust may recover under those insurance policies either by invoking the common law presumption of death or by establishing, irrespective of the common law presumption of death, that Gordon Beeler is, in fact, dead.
Except the trust did not present any evidence, direct or circumstantial, on actual death, as I understand the record. Isn't that right?
No, to the contrary, Your Honor. The trust did present such evidence in the form of all of the facts and circumstances that give rise to the presumption as well, namely that Gordon Beeler disappeared at the end of January 1998, took no money with him, accessed none of his resources after he disappeared, took cash and traveler's checks. Cash is important because it's non-traceable. And instead of keeping it as walking around money, he sent it back to his widow. He has not been seen or heard from despite a diligent search, not only by the family that hired Clarence Kelly, the former FBI director, to search for him, but also by two international insurance companies that had very significant financial incentives to find him. He has missed birthdays, graduations, other events in the life of his family.
Right. That's all evidence that gives rise to the presumption. That's not evidence of actual death, as in the case where there was a body in a house and the house was torched, etc., but the body could not be identified. At least that's some evidence of actual somebody died.
That is the Roberts case to which Your Honor refers, and I will refer to that in a moment. But I submit that the same facts and circumstances that support application of the presumption of death also are the facts and circumstances that support a conclusion, Your Honor, that after the passage of so many years with no word from or about Gordon Beeler, he is in fact dead. And that indeed was the conclusion of Judge Bowers in the parallel case in the Elkhart Circuit Court. Judge Bowers concluded not only that the presumption of death arose and was rebutted, but he also included, independent of the presumption of death, that given all of the facts and circumstances that I outlined for you briefly, Your Honor, that Gordon Beeler is in fact dead, as a matter of fact, irrespective of the presumption. So a very reasonable judge, on hearing the identical facts presented to this jury, but which the jury was not allowed to address for purposes of deciding the question of actual death, a very reasonable state court judge, applying Indiana law as he understands and interprets it, concluded not only that Gordon Beeler is dead under the presumption, but also that Gordon Beeler is dead, as a matter of fact, irrespective of the presumption. Now, at the end of a week-long jury trial, Judge Sharp made two fundamental errors. One, he set the bar for invoking the presumption of death under Indiana law higher than the bar exists for establishing death by a preponderance of the evidence, irrespective of the presumption. Secondly, although he changed at our request instruction number 22 to clarify a mistake in his original draft of instruction 22 to make clear that we had the right to go to the jury on the alternative evidentiary path to establish death, namely proof by a preponderance of the evidence that it is more likely than not that Gordon Buehler is dead without the presumption. He refused to fix the verdict form and therefore never let that question go to the jury, although the question should have gone, by all accounts, and as I said in the parallel state court proceeding, carried the day. Now, the court's initial draft of Instruction 22 was right out of the case law. It was precisely what we tendered. At the urging of the insurance carriers during the instruction settlement conference, however, Judge Sharp added language for which there is no support in the case law and that set the bar, as I say, higher for invoking the presumption of death than for proving death outright, irrespective of the presumption. He said that in addition to showing an absence for 7 years, a failure to communicate with those with whom you would expect him to communicate, and that the missing person can't be found despite a diligent search, he said it's also necessary to show that his absence is, and I quote, unexplained by circumstances other than those suggesting death. The absence is unexplained by circumstances other than those suggesting death. That is squarely at odds with the two appellate cases from the state of Indiana that are on point, Equitable and Roberts. Equitable from 1920 and Roberts case from 1980. In each of those two cases, the missing person was a fugitive from death. There was a clear, plausible explanation for the missing person's absence other than death. Yet in each case, as a matter of law, the presumption was held to have arisen. In Roberts, as Your Honor noted, Clarence Roberts had kidnapped and murdered another to fake his own death. Exhumation of that body revealed that the dead body was not that of Clarence Roberts. It was the body of another. So Clarence Roberts clearly had a motive to run. He was a fugitive about to be arrested. Same with the missing person in Equitable. The missing person in Equitable had committed bank fraud and was about to be arrested. In each case, however, the presumption of death was held to have arisen. The problem in our case, however, is that Judge Sharp, at the insurance company's behest, told these jurors that the only way we could invoke the presumption of death, the only way we could invoke the presumption of death would be by showing that no circumstances except those suggesting death can explain his absence. Now, if a family can make that showing, that no circumstances except those suggesting death can explain his absence, there's no need for the presumption. If you can make that showing, then only the circumstances suggesting death can explain the absence, and it follows that the missing person is necessarily dead, and you don't need to invoke the presumption. Now, is this necessarily what that language meant? It is absolutely what that language meant, and it is absolutely why the insurance companies fought so hard to get it in. And to underscore the point, I would like to quote from what the insurance carriers told the jury in closing argument. And I'm reading from passages in the May 29th transcript, beginning at page 71. Quote, "What this case boils down to a large extent, are two words in that clause, inexplicably absent." Page 72, "The judge is going to tell you, as used in these instructions, the phrase inexplicably absent means that his absence is unexplained by circumstances other than those suggesting death. It really is, to a large extent, the key to the case." Page 73, "I emphatically say to you," that the answer to that question is no. It's not unexplained. It's not inexplicable why he left home. Is it explained? Is the only explanation for his leaving and for his absence death? Of course not, said the insurance companies. The evidence suggests death is the only explanation. The only explanation, that's not the case here. Page 74. As his disappearance occurred amid the destruction of his family relationships, that is obviously a circumstance that suggests something other than death. And that's why you should find that the presumption of death does not apply. And finally, page 106. Is his absence unexplained by circumstances other than death? Is death the only explanation? Are you kidding me? Not even close. Judge Sharp set the bar for invoking the presumption of death higher than the bar exists for proving death by a preponderance of the evidence, irrespective of the presumption, and we couldn't clear it. Finally, on this point, please consider this. We could have brought this lawsuit in year two, or year three, or any year prior to the expiration of seven, after Gordon Buehler became missing. In that event, we had the absolute right to go to the jury on the question whether it is more likely than not that he is dead, given all of the facts and circumstances, the very facts and circumstances that Judge Bowers, in the parallel state court case in Elkhart County, found compelling and persuasive and proof of death, irrespective of the presumption. Had we been able to do that, the burden of proof applicable to that claim would have been, have we shown by a preponderance of the evidence that it is more likely than not, given all of the facts and circumstances, that Gordon Buehler is dead? Well, yet the burden of proof that was imposed upon us for invoking the presumption was that we had to discount every potential explanation for death other than circumstances suggesting death. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, there's clearly a problem with the instruction here in the special verdict form. My question is with respect to the parallel state court proceeding that you've referenced a couple of times now. What was that, a probate matter?
No, Your Honor. That was a separate case brought by the business partner of Gordon Buehler. Gordon Buehler and his business partner, who jointly owned a business, had key person insurance on each other.
Okay.
And in that parallel state court case, it was identical to the federal case, save tried in state court and brought on behalf of the business partner against a different insurance company, Valley Forge, seeking to collect a $300,000 insurance policy.
Was there an appeal?
There was not an appeal.
No appeal. So we won't have anything forthcoming from the Indiana appellate courts on this presumption of death, unfortunately. We have to go back to these old cases.
You will not, Your Honor, although there is a lengthy opinion, a very thoughtful, well-done opinion that Judge Bowers wrote, some 30 pages, as I recall, that is in the record before, Your Honor.
In the fact that the Indiana Supreme Court has never spoken to this issue.
That's correct, sir. The Indiana Supreme Court has never spoken on this issue. We think that the Clarence Roberts case and the Equitable Life Insurance case from 1920 are very clear on the issue, but to the extent the court feels that guidance from the Indiana Supreme Court would be helpful, we believe this is tailor-made for certification to the Indiana Supreme Court. I'd like to say a brief word about the verdict form. As I noted, Judge Sharp, at my urging, corrected an error in Instruction 22. As he originally crafted it, Instruction 22 said, If you find that the presumption of death doesn't arise, then put your pencils down and don't go to any other questions on the verdict form. And I explained, with no objection whatsoever from the carriers, I explained, Your Honor, That's not correct. They're not done if they conclude that the presumption of death doesn't arise. If they conclude it doesn't arise, then they have to address the separate independent question whether we have proven, as a matter of fact, irrespective of the presumption, that Gordon Buehler is dead. And he said, you're right, I'll change that language, and he did so. Then, however, the error recurred in the verdict form. Question one on the verdict form said, do you find that the presumption of death has arisen? If your answer to that question is no, put your pencils down, you're done.
Did you ask him to change the verdict?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I did so. I did so on the morning of before we delivered our closing arguments, and I was quite emphatic about it, and he declined to do it for reasons that I can't offer. And so he took away the alternative path by which we could have proven what Judge Bowers concluded we did in fact prove in the parallel state court case.
Thank you, Mr. Erzl.
Thank you.
Mr. Poles.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Ted Poulos. I represent AXA and ReliaStar Life Insurance Companies. My clients issued life insurance policies in a total amount of approximately $2.5 million. And Gordon Buehler disappeared in late January of 1998. Obviously, life insurance companies, before they pay out $2.5 million, want some assurance that the person whose life is covered is in fact deceased. And Judge Sykes, you're absolutely right. There is zero evidence that Gordon Buehler died or that he is deceased. The only evidence is the evidence leading up to his disappearance. And that evidence explains why Gordon Buehler is not here. It explains his absence, because the only thing the plaintiffs had here was the simple fact of Gordon Buehler's absence. And absence is not alone. On that, I don't think there's any dispute. All the authorities, Indiana authorities, the treatises on this subject, make clear that absence alone is not sufficient to give rise to the presumption. And so what Judge Sharp did with the jury instructions, and then Judge Sharp, I believe, became ill, and Judge Lee took over in the post-trial stage. What Judge Sharp and Judge Lee both agreed is that Roberts is the leading case, the leading Indiana case on this subject, and there was no dispute about the requirement that a person be inexplicably absent in order to invoke the presumption.
Well, let's talk about what that terminology means. That's what this case turns on, and how it was defined in the jury instruction is determinative of this appeal. That phrase, inexplicably absent, is in the Roberts case. It's not, if you trace back the old case law, anywhere in the old articulation of the common law presumption. So that's a new word that creeps into Indiana case law as of 1980, when the Roberts case was decided by the Court of Appeals. But before that time, the presumption would arise upon proof of a continuous absence of 7 years and no communication, no tidings in the nice phrase of the old cases, and a diligent search. Those were the three elements of proof that would give rise to the presumption. And alternative explanations for the absence would go to the question of whether the presumption was rebutted, and then perhaps the ultimate fact question of whether the alleged deceased is in fact deceased. But it wouldn't go to the question of whether the presumption arises in the first place. So that's my first question, and then we can talk about the definition of inexplicably absent that the district court offered here. But if you would address yourself to that question about how that phrase crept into the common law presumption in Indiana.
Sure. I don't believe that Roberts is the first indication that there was some requirement that there's this issue of, is his absence explained or unexplained in order to give rise to presumption. I don't think it came out of the blue in Roberts. In Metropolitan Life Insurance Company versus Lyons, the Indiana Supreme Court, and it was in passing, it was in 1912, in discussing the presumption, said if the person alleged to be dead has been absent from his home for 7 years, a presumption of death may arise, but proof of absence alone will not give rise to this presumption. And then it went on to explain, if it is known that he established a fixed residence abroad, proof that his family and friends have heard nothing from him from 7 years will not be sufficient to establish the presumption of death. I think we also cited in our brief a case from 130 some years ago, Davy versus Brigg, the United States Supreme Court, which also touched on that exact Davy versus Briggs, 1878, that also in articulating the common law 7 year presumption of death said that the general rule undoubtedly is that a person shown not to have been heard from 7 years by those, if any, who, if he had been alive, would naturally have heard from him, is presumed dead unless the circumstances of the case are such as to account for his not being heard of without assuming death. And that's really the explanation that the court gave for inexplicably absent. So it seems to me, and
wasn't the presumption triggered in Roberts?
The presumption, the trial court found in Roberts that the presumption had been triggered and that it was rebutted. On appeal, the life insurance companies there didn't contest whether or not the presumption had arisen in the first instance. They argued instead that they didn't prove that his death occurred within the period of the contract, that the life insurance policies had lapsed. But importantly, in Roberts, because I think the appellants here claim that in Roberts there was a finding that the presumption arose as a matter of law simply based on the seven-year absence, and I'll point to, and I don't believe that that's the case. The appellate court in Roberts said that the Robertses introduced evidence from which the trier of fact could conclude that Clarence Roberts had been absent from home without explanation for a continuous period exceeding 7 years. Without explanation. But
that's the one where he faked his own death to avoid answering for forgery?
I think he faked his own death to provide a body to try to fool everybody that, in fact, he was dead. It wasn't that he committed a murder and then had to run. It's that as part of intending to run and become a fugitive, he faked his own death and to provide a body. So there was some indication there was a possible motive for him to leave, but a possible motive isn't enough. In order to invoke the presumption, I think as the Roberts case indicates there and as these other authorities suggest, there has to be an unexplained absence. He is inexplicable. Take the case of the husband and father going down to the store to get a gallon of milk, and he's never heard from again. That absence is unexplained.
Well, his status as a fugitive would explain the absence, and the Roberts court held that the presumption arose in that case without regard to that circumstantial explanation, and that it was the insurance company's obligation to come forward with rebuttal, right, which, you know, then brought in all of those surrounding circumstances. But if that status of Mr. Roberts as a fugitive was enough to prevent the presumption from arising, then the court's analysis would have ended there, and it didn't.
Your Honor, I believe in that case there was an issue as to whether his having committed a forgery was sufficient grounds for him to run. And as I say, the Roberts opinion is not the most illuminating on exactly what had occurred below, except that it does say there was sufficient evidence from which a trier of fact could conclude that he had been absent without explanation. And so there was a focus on the issue of an explanation, and I think the treatises and the other authorities all focus on it has to be an unexplained and, or inexplicable absence. And here, Gordon Beeler didn't vanish, just didn't disappear out of thin air. There was a long, tortured history of a deteriorating relationship with his wife and his children, where he had been kicked out of the house several times, where he, on the date that he went to court for a restraining order, he rented a storage locker in an alias name using fraudulent identification from Florida, where he wrote a goodbye note saying, I've cleaned the condo in Florida, so there is no trace of me. And then, of course, there were four witnesses who said that they saw him. So the presumption I submit, and what the cases seem to indicate, that you can't get the presumption of the benefit to trigger the insurance company's requirement of rebuttal. You can't get that merely with a 7 years absence. And that's all they had here. And what the evidence showed, however, at trial was overwhelming evidence of an intent to leave. There was the handwritten note that he faxed to his wife from Florida saying, you know, you kicked me out of the house six or seven times, and I asked you, is this how you want to end it? This is a week before he left. Is this the way you want to end it? You responded, I could care less if I ever see you again. That sign sounds final, is what he said. And then, of course, the last communication is a communication that said, I've cleaned the counter, there's no trace of me. The children said they wanted the money, now they have it. Here's where the stocks are. There was a clear explanation for his departure. And I have to say that jury instruction 22 on this requirement of inexplicably absent in order to trigger the presumption is that portion of the instruction, at least, was something that was agreed to by the parties. There was no objection from the plaintiffs on that issue. That is, that they have to show the circumstances have to be suggest inexplicable absence.
Well, the question is how that's defined.
Right.
And Judge Sharp defined it as Beeler's absence is unexplained by circumstances other than those suggesting death, which is the ultimate fact question in here. That's not it's not phrased in terms of presumption language. That's the ultimate fact. And that, it seems to me, is error. Ask the jury to decide the ultimate fact when deciding mm-hmm. whether a presumption arises, an evidentiary presumption,
mm-hmm.
that shifts the burden of production.
Right. The language was, and again, it comes right out of Roberts. Once there's...
That part doesn't.
Right. Once the phrase inexplicably absence is included...
Right, but the definition...
Out of Roberts, right?
Right.
Then it has to mean something, and I think there is some potential ambiguity there.
Find help from the Indiana Supreme Court, then?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't we find help from the Indiana Supreme Court, what that means?
I don't believe that's necessary in light of what Roberts and in fact, the Indiana Supreme Court said in 1912 about the circumstances suggesting something other than death. As we indicated,
that's not what Roberts stands for, though, in context. This definition doesn't square with
right.
the context of Roberts.
I believe that Roberts stands for the proposition that in order to invoke the presumption, he has to be absent for 7 years, and it has to be inexplicably absent. And in Lyons, back in 1912, the Supreme Court, again, did say absence alone is not enough to trigger the presumption that it has to be there has to be some evidence sufficient to establish that presumption of death. That is, absence is unexplained. And I submit that this definition doesn't go to the ultimate fact. It simply says that inexplicably absent means that it's unexplained by circumstances other than death. That in other words, in order to get to that presumption, there has to be an absence of circumstances that suggest only that death is the only likely explanation here.
How is that not a statement of the ultimate fact question in the case?
I believe, Your Honor, that simply goes to, okay, are there circumstances that explain his absence? Is there reason to believe that he is not dead before you get that presumption? And there's nothing to suggest that Otherwise, Your Honor, the 7-year absence alone would be sufficient.
And well, not exactly. I mean, there's a difference between, you know, an absence without explanation as a factual matter and the ultimate fact question in the case. I'm using these as terms of art, as I'm sure you understand. The ultimate fact question in the case is that he's dead, and this instruction is phrased in terms that ask the jury to decide that ultimate fact question in deciding the threshold matter of whether the plaintiff gets the benefit of the presumption. And it seems to me that's not right in terms of how presumptions are supposed to work. You know, you prove some basic evidentiary facts, and then you get the presumption. The other side has to come forward with evidence, which either explodes or doesn't explode the presumption, and then you get to the ultimate fact.
My only response to that is that the law, I believe, is clear that it requires that it be inexplicably absent. That has to mean something. And here it means that it's an unexplained absence. And what could an unexplained absence mean other than, really, that there aren't circumstances that suggest something other than death? And it really is something that just that suggestion. So was there some explanation for it? And here there was ample explanation for the absence, which, independent of a presumption or a suggestion of death. And the way I acknowledge that there was, as far as how the presumption operates itself, I submit that before insurance companies are required to rebut the presumption and go forward, that in order to get the benefit of this presumption, the 7-year absence is not enough, and there has to be but only when there is an unexplained absence, that's what triggers the presumption. And I know that the whole issue sounds somewhat circular. And I should say, and I know the red light's on, one brief comment. To a large extent, this whole issue for me is borders on the metaphysical of how many angels can dance on the pin in the head.
Well, no. This means something as far as how juries consider the evidence.
Right.
And the jury was told to not answer any of the subsequent questions on the special verdict if it concluded, pursuant to this instruction, that the presumption of death did not arise. So we can assume that the jury followed those instructions and didn't proceed any further.
But I think in light of the evidence here, it is also fair to assume and recognize that the issue was his absence explained? And whether it's a question of is it explained in the context of determining whether the presumption arises, or in determining whether it's been rebutted, or in determining the ultimate question, there was an explanation, and the jury presumably so found in answering that requirement, or in saying no, that they have not established that he is inexplicably absent. And that was the argument, and the stark contrast that was involved in this trial. Was there an explanation for his absence, or should we think that he is dead because he is absent under these circumstances?
Well, that's an argument that you might win before a properly instructed jury.
Yeah.
Not that you won for the right reasons before this jury.
Judge Sykes, I think that given the way the presumption has evolved, and I certainly understand that comment, the evidence was overwhelming that just overwhelming. I don't believe that there can be a finding of prejudice here, and Judge Lee made that determination in a very lengthy and, I thought, thoughtful opinion.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute to...
Happy to answer any questions the court has of me at this point. If the court has none, I would simply urge the court to read the discussion of this court's opinion in Green v. Shalala, the 1995 case that also construed the common law presumption of death in accordance with the common law and reached the very conclusion on a parallel question that we are urging here. And we respectfully, therefore, urge this court to remand for a new trial or to certify the question to the Indiana Supreme Court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel for excellent briefs and argument today. We move to the third.